Thank you very much, Ed, and my co-panelists and fellow Philadelphia Society members. I got a kind of cryptic communication from Commodore Lipset about the subject of this panel, and he said he wanted a discussion of some of the crises confronting this country institutionally with respect to aspects of government. And I don't really have to cover the problems because I think you're all totally conversant with them. So I jotted down some thoughts here on some of the solutions to problems, and let me briefly run through them. And I don't want to impinge on Ken's discussion of the executive branch, but I've got some random thoughts on reforms, I think, with respect to the federal government in a broader sense that I would like to include, along with a discussion of the bureaucracy, lobbying groups, pressure groups, and the Congress itself. I'll focus more specifically on the Congress. Back in 1978, I visited Youngstown, Ohio, and met with some union leaders to discuss with them the reasons why they perceived Youngstown Sheet and Tube to have gone belly up. It cost 4,600 jobs, and it represented a kind of death blow to the community of Youngstown because they lost the tax revenues from the plant, and, of course, they lost the tax revenues from the 4,600 employees, and as the former mayor told me, they would lose that many more, and people who were in service-related industries that were dependent upon that population and that revenue. And as the mayor said, you want to see how urban blight starts, this is how it starts. We have ongoing capital commitments to build schools and playgrounds and sidewalks and sewers and so forth. We've lost our revenue base, and who wants to settle in Youngstown? It's kind of a grungy steel town anyway. And with the escalating taxes that we're going to have to impose, on the one hand, that's going to chase future businesses off, or else you're going to watch the erosion and deterioration of our city. What was remarkable to me in the meeting with the union leaders was their perception of why Youngstown Sheet and Tube went under. And amongst other things, they assumed some degree of, and appropriately, of blame for the wages that they had managed to extract from Youngstown. And they blamed management, too, for a failure to modernize and renovate the plant. But the straw that broke the camel's back, according to them, was an EPA regulation and the capricious, arbitrary deadlines established by the Congress for conformity to some of these regulations with respect to clean water. And one of them said in a fit of frustration and near rage, he said, "I don't give a blankety blank blank if there are never any blankety blank fish in that Mahoning River. That river wasn't made for fish, it was made to produce steel." It was an overstatement, but I understood his anxiety and frustration because a lot of those people there, you know, were first-generation immigrants, and like many first-generation immigrants, they found good salaries, even though, as I say, it was kind of a dirty steel town. They owned their own home, something remarkable to many of them in contrast to their old-world experience, and their kids were going to Ohio State and looking forward to a better life. And suddenly the dream ended. Well, the thought crossed my mind that had the Congress been asked to vote on killing 4,600 jobs, there's no way that ever would have happened. The Congress would have made some kind of an accommodation and said, well, stretch out Youngstown Sheet and Tube's deadline for being in conformity with the Clean Water Guidelines if the alternative is to force the closing of a plant like that. And Mickey Edwards and I subsequently prepared a bill that we submitted, and we bounced it off these union leaders every stage of the development because it was my conviction that there was a commonality of interest between conservatives and union leaders, most recently unemployed union leaders, on many fundamental questions. And so we did that, and we ended up with a bill where no one made a concession, but one of the most important ingredients, and one that I think is essential to restore control over the policymaking function by the Congress, was to establish, in giving guidelines on implementing policy generating in an abstract way out of the Congress, give some guidelines with regards to such things as cost-benefit ratios, the determination of whether the implementation through a rule or a regulation or guideline might cause any unemployment. If it violated any of those criteria, then it would have to be submitted for affirmative action before it could go into effect to both bodies of Congress. because in our frustration over having delegated the authority to make policy to the executive branch, to administer the policy, and with the development of administrative law, also to sit as judge, jury, and executioner of their own cases, we've permitted this fusion of legislative, executive, and judicial functions in a body, a fourth branch of government, accountable to no one. Because the fact is, they resent any administration. They don't care whether it's Republican or Democrat. Anyone that attempts to tamper with their fief is one who is viewed as suspect and dangerous, and hence they hold Congress in contempt and resentment. They hold the American people in the same light, and they hold any administration in that light. And we've lost accountability, and a congressional veto, to me, is not the answer. Our function is to make policy. The executive branch's function is to exercise the veto. So that's one reform with respect to the bureaucracy that I think would go a long way. Secondly, with regard to lobbying and pressure groups, I think if they would lift the restriction on individual contributions in campaigns, you could greatly minimize the impact that these lobbying and pressure groups are generating. And frankly, I've run around the country ever since they put the restriction on individual giving, urging all businesses and trade associations to get organized as quickly as possible and form PACs so that they can make contributions and make their voices heard. And this in response to what the unions had been doing for many years. But having witnessed the evolution of many of these political action committees, there's a degree of arrogance that sets in even on the part of our people in attempting to leverage in behalf of special legislation. And I won't mention any names, but Ed knows because he was with me when we had a colleague from a western state who now seemingly represents business interests in Washington. And occasionally they take a wrong position, and they're positively overbearing. And I can't blame them. They've got their interests, and they'll go to bat for them, and they'll use the liberal distribution of money to gain access to members and also to influence members. But that has been a direct consequence of putting that limitation on individual contributions. It wasn't necessary to resort to PACs until the Congress took that action. With regard to the Congress, there are several, and I'm going to quickly run through these because we're on tight time constraints, and Ed's going to pull me off here. First of all, this whole budget nonsense that we went through the last couple of weeks, I voted for congressional budgeting, and the Congress, in fact, should prepare budgets, not the administration, but the fact is it's not working. It's just a total waste of time. The Congress cannot be bound by the budget process as it stands now. And after they establish a budget, when it gets to the implementation by passing the individual appropriation measures, as Jamie Whitten, the Democratic chairman of Appropriations Committee, said recently, there's no way the Congress can bind this committee. And indeed, they can't. So the individual appropriation bills invariably come in excess of their own budgetary guidelines, and that's when they finally get to putting a budget together. Frankly, until we can put some teeth into the budget process by somehow linking it to authorizations, I don't think that this budget business is worth the effort. It's an inordinate preoccupation on the part of the Congress with the process, and as I say, the process is absolutely meaningless because what we did on Thursday of this week is as dead in the water as far as implementation as what President Reagan proposed when he sent his first budget up to Congress. Second, there ought to be a rigid timetable for authorizing and appropriating. And if a committee cannot get a bill out, an authorization or an appropriation by that rigid timetable, then the rule ought to be that you're going to be carried at the same level of spending of last year, and that's not subject to change. Because they drag their feet and we get into the end of a session, and then all of a sudden they're scrambling. People are putting together parts of a package. No one has the vaguest idea what's in those bills, and that's when they actually get the bills up for passage. Because normally they do it through a continuing resolution because they haven't passed the appropriation bills, and then there are Christmas tree ornaments invariably attached to that. And the process, as I said, is one that is built in, I think guaranteed, to continue this irresponsible, reckless increase in spending. Shorter sessions. Ideally, that Congress shouldn't be in session more than 6 months a year. In the best of worlds, we get back to the old fiscal year, and that is convene in January, get down to business, and get out of there by the 1st of July. But along with that, another reform in my book that's dictated is to lift this restriction on outside earned income to give those fellows an incentive to get back home and hopefully try and make a buck in the real world. I think putting a freeze right now on all congressional salaries while lifting that restriction on outside earned income would be an appropriate thing to do as well. If you have full reporting and accountability to your constituents as to how you're earning your money, and I'm for that, I don't mind disclosing that to my constituents, but once having done that, the question of whether I'm spending too much time with my work at home versus my work in Washington is a decision to be made by my constituents. And if they're unhappy with the work at home, they'll communicate that through the ballot box. There are just two more quick ones here I want to touch upon. We have two-year House sessions. I think appropriations ought to be over a two-year period, and the first year a new Congress convenes. Get the appropriations over 2 years and then reserve that second year, which is an election year, exclusively to the exercise of oversight. Oversight and reviewing legislation with a view to taking bills off the books. Because we do not exercise any oversight anymore. And in addition to that, once you get into an election year like this, you know, you can throw responsibility out the window because there will be no responsibility in any election year. And that phenomenon has escalated in the 15 years I've been there. It's gotten worse each new term. And if we reserve that second year for oversight, we wouldn't get a lot of this effort at trying to buy the public's votes with this pet piece of legislation versus that, and we would be exercising a part of the oversight that we've abandoned. Then finally, there should be a limitation on terms. You know, if we selected congressmen the way we select jurors, they'd go to Washington with a totally different mental attitude. And I am co-sponsor of an amendment that would limit Senate terms to two six-year Senate terms and 6 2-year House terms, and I've revised my thinking on that. I think it should be limited to 1 6-year Senate term and 3 2-year House terms. And to those who worry about the bureaucracy taking control or staff running the Congress, I guarantee you that's not the case, because a fellow going to Washington knowing that he's going to have to live under the laws that are crafted in that town for a majority of his life is going to have the testosterone to say no when it comes to all these lobbying groups and special interests. And I won't mention a name, but I cast one vote against the House on this disability bill. The vote was 410-1. And there is a rather liberal Republican friend of ours from up in one of these Midwestern states who I was visiting with night before last, and he said, "Phil, you know, I was standing in the back of the room with another one of our colleagues on the committee, and we both knew that that was the right vote, and we concluded if the no votes got into double-digit figures, we'd vote no, too." Well, now, see, that's the problem. And once a member makes the determination that he is going to vote against his conscience because of the fear of the political fallout, you've got someone compromised who at that point becomes a part of the problem. And I've seen it happen to too many, and it's especially true of these freshman members. These young fellows come down there, and they anguish in the well. And I told them they should have been down there in the good old days, you know, when we had 5,000 students descend upon us in 1 month because of the Cambodian incursion, and to get the specific pointed barbed threats that they're either going to retire you or blow you up. Those were the good old days, and, you know, you get battle-tempered through that experience. But a lot of these fellows are intimidated by that, and they are caving in, and a lot of them are our kind of people. And as I say, if you had that short period of service down there, it would be service to your country. I'll quickly run through the recommendations on government line item vetoes. I think that's a positive reform that should be implemented. The balanced budget amendment, that balanced budget amendment contains, as perhaps some of you don't know, a limitation as a percentage of GNP on what government can spend, which is a vital ingredient of it. Because if it were simply a balanced budget, you could mandate, you know, such an enormous escalation of taxes. None of us wants to see the budget balanced that way. But that is a constitutional amendment, I think, is absolutely essential. I think getting back to a gold standard is absolutely essential. It provided an external discipline on the natural predisposition of politicians to spend more than they take in. And once you can engage in legal counterfeiting, as they do, the compulsion is there to go ahead and do that. And that's exactly what that national government of ours is doing. And you know and I know that if we could go in our basement and legally crank up the printing press to cover our excesses, we'd engage in it sooner or later. That temptation is beyond resisting. And finally, moving the departments of government, which is a recommendation I made in that presidential campaign, to logical places, like agriculture should be out in Des Moines. And move the Department of Commerce to Chicago, transportation to Detroit, OSHA to Nome, Alaska. I think then you would begin to find out who the real dedicated public servants are. Because a part of the attraction, very frankly, is the glamour and the increasing allure of a town that is being subsidized by all of you in the hinterland. And Jefferson warned, you know, about that concentration of our cultural and financial and political capital in one town. And dispersing it, and that's a good move in the right direction, dispersing it that way would go a long way in terms of implementing the final reform, and that's the one President Reagan has proposed in the new federalism concept. We've got to get the national government back to the basics, and they're contained in four departments. That's state, defense, treasury, and justice. And all the rest of them are not national functions. And increasingly, as the country grows and as the problems become more complicated, that's the best argument for decentralizing those responsibilities and brushing aside the argument that states will not act in a responsible way. Thank you.
I remember the first time we heard Phil Crane at a Philadelphia Society meeting, I think it was about 1967 or 68. At that time, he was a college professor, and he talked rather leisurely for about 48 minutes, knowing just when the bell was going to ring at the end of the 50-minute period. You can see now he's been under the gavel of Tip O'Neill there and can really cram a lot into a very short period. That was terrific.